I'm going to begin with reading you a sonnet with a rapper. I once heard on an old field recording a wandering mendicant sing this particular song in Tibetan, one of those old Nonesuch recordings that were done years ago. It's extremely... You have to imagine that as I read this in a not very well translated English translation, you have to imagine an old man singing this song with incredible yearning, longing, right from the depths of the heart. To see my father guru's face and hear his voice transforms this beggar's sorrow into vital heart breath. Recollecting the exemplary guru, reverence dawns deep within my heart. Blessings and kindness directly enter me. All destructive thoughts are banished. Though this lamenting song, recalling you, might annoy you, know that this beggar sorrows in the darkness, filled with loss and longing. So, my guru, protect and sustain me with your kindness. Blazing meditation, born of heartfelt perseverance, is my service to please you, Father Guru. Wander in the wilderness alone is my service to please the Dharkanis. Selfless practice of the Dharma is my service to the Buddha's teachings. Uniting life and meditation is my gift to helpless fellow sentient beings. To strive in life through happiness and sorrow is the broom that sweeps away karma and the defilements. The fortitude of abstaining from the food of pollution is the basis for transcendental realization. I shall repay my Father Guru's kindness through repeated meditation. Nurture me with kindness, O Supreme Guru. Bless this beggar to succeed in his hermit's isolation. So this is a song from a story of Milarepa called The Tale of Red Rock Jewel Valley. They go for these names in the Tibetan. It sounds like something out of a Western, doesn't it? Red Rock Jewel Valley. And what's happened, Milarepa's left his great guru Marpa, Jetsun Marpa, the great Dharma Lord Marpa. And he's gone off into retreat. Marpa has said, the way I want you to practice is to devote yourself to solitary meditation in the snow ranges and the mountains. Interestingly enough, Marpa himself was a married man with a big family, a landowner, apparently a very worldly looking man, but he wanted his disciple to practice meditation, to practice in isolation, to live a renunciate's life, a beggar's life. So Milarepa, after his training, I might say a bit about his training a bit later with Marpa, because it was a very unusual training. Milarepa went off into the fastnesses of the Himalayas, the Red Rock Jewel Valley, and he practiced and practiced. And just before this song, he feels terribly lonely, terribly sad and full of longing to see his teacher, to see Father Guru Marpa, to see Father Guru Marpa's wife, Dharmema, Nairatmya, selflessness, Marpa's wonderfully devoted wife, who cared for Milarepa as if he was her son, and helped him so much with a very difficult guru in his training. He wanted also to see his brothers, his Dharma brothers and sisters, who also trained with Marpa. So there he was, alone, really feeling that they weren't there. And then he sang a great song. Marpa appears in a great vision and speaks to him and encourages him. So this song is a response to that vision. When I see my father guru's face and to hear his words, transforms this beggar's sorrow into vital heart breath. Recollecting the exemplary guru, reverence dawns deep within my heart. To see my father guru's face and hear his voice transforms this beggar's sorrow into vital heart breath. There's so many things packed into a line like this, that so many assumptions which are so different from ours. In a way, it's really weird giving a talk on Milarepa in the middle of London. It would be really weird giving it in a country mansion in Norfolk where I live. It's such a different world as I look out on laptops and video recordings, and you know, knowing that you've probably got smartphones in your pockets and things like that, and I'm talking about a beggar, a hermit in the mountains, living on next to nothing, and talking about the vision of his guru. But there's so much warmth in this first verse. To see my father guru's face and hear his voice. We need to say something about Milarepa's relationship with Marpa. We need to say something about this beggar's sorrow and, of course, the vital heart breath. Milarepa, you probably know, I don't know where you're up to in your studies of Milarepa, but Milarepa was in desperation, really, when he came to Marpa. He'd had a good start in life, really. He'd born into a very wealthy family, but as often happens in these sorts of societies, his father died. He didn't make the will properly, really, and Milarepa and his mother and his sister were really cheated out of their inheritance by their paternal uncle, treated very badly. Turned into paupers, really. And Milarepa's mother was very, very vengeful indeed, very bitter. And she encouraged Milarepa to take revenge on the uncle, on her brother-in-law, and all of their relatives. And Milarepa, being a very, his name wasn't Milarepa then, by the way, I forget what his name was before he started. Milarepa means a repo is means somebody who wears a cotton cloth. So he's Miller who wears the cotton cloth in the snow ranges. But anyway, Milarepa, when he was a boy, he learned black magic. He went off. You could learn these things apparently in Tibet. He went off to a particular lama, probably a Nyingmapa learner, and he learnt all the magic rites of destruction associated with a particularly ferocious protector deity. I won't tell you his name, because apparently if you invoke this deity, he doesn't go away, but just to give you some idea, he's got the body of a serpent, and the top of his body is just covered in eyes and mouths. And he releases scorpions and other terrible things. So he learned this practice and the mantras of this practice, really mastered the rites of destruction. And there's a terrible moment where there's this wedding feast of the son of the uncle, and Milarepa wreaks havoc with his black magic. The whole family is destroyed and wiped out. It's completely kind of cleaned out. So basically, Milarepa is a murderer. Milarepa is a mass murderer, a black magician, encouraged by his vengeful mother. I mean, what a start. I mean, sort out the psychology, therapists. What do you do with that? Where do you go with that? I mean, this is a terrible situation. Where's this going to go? Where is this going to end up? I mean, in a way, Milarepa's sort of a kind of innocent. He's just doing what mum asks, you know what I mean? Loves his mum. He really loves his mum. You know, he's a devoted son, loves his sister. Mum wants something done, so he does it. You know, he's very, very single-minded in that way. Again, you know, sort out the psychology. But he realizes after a while, after the, you know, I can't remember all the details offhand of what happened, but he's deeply, deeply troubled by what has happened. And he realizes that he's got to seek the Dharma. He's got to find a way of dealing with this situation, because life is, you know, you live like that, things are going to start kicking off karmically. He finds a teacher who assures him that through this particular method, it's called Dzogchen, through this particular method, enlightenment is assured, I think within about a week. I mean, apparently this, you know, you can do this these days, you can go on the internet, you can get enlightened in a few days, apparently. It's very, very, very simple. You know, you don't even have to come to the Buddhist Center. You can just log on, apparently, and have a groovy kind of online conversation, and you're liberated. Never tried it myself. But anyway, they didn't have those facilities in Milarepa's day. But, amazingly, and the teacher was really amazed by this, Milarepa didn't get enlightened within a week. The teacher said, well, this is very unusual. This has never happened before. You know, so there must be something wrong, you know, and you need to go and find another teacher. So Milarepa, you know, he really does know that he needs to do something. He's troubled, deeply troubled, as you can expect from killing all those people. And he hears the name Marpa. Marpa. He hears the name Jetson Marpa, who lives so many valleys away. And as soon as he hears the name Marpa, he's absolutely thrilled. He just knows, that's my teacher. He hears the name Marpa. This is not unusual in the Buddhist tradition. I mean, you get stories of people just hearing the word Buddha, and they know this is it. This is absolutely thrilling. They know they have to do something. Even in these days, you know, I remember when I was a youngster, I heard the word Tibet. I think I just heard the word. And I knew I had to find out something about it. I knew I had to find out something about this country. I don't know why. I don't know what the circumstances were, but there was something about that sparked something off. We get these inspirations. Perhaps this is the vital heart, breath, energy. It's a sort of manifestation of that. We're called to something. So Milarepa is called Marpa. So he seeks him out. He wanders and wanders, keeps asking people where Marpa is, and eventually he is getting near to, he's in Marpa's area, and he comes across a man, very stout, stocky, fierce looking farmer, ploughing his field, wearing a black chubba, a black tunic, with cropped hair, very fierce features, but very practical. He's got his yaks or whatever they are, ploughing the field, and he's a little bit tipsy because he's having a good swig on his chang, you know, his barley beer, and it's hot. And Milarepa says, can you tell me where Marpa lives? So the man says, oh yeah, Marpa lives over there. If you finish ploughing the field, I'll go and tell him that you're coming, you know, to have a bit of a chat. If you can plough the field for me, I'll go off, because I'm getting a bit tired. I'll go off and tell Marpa that, you know, he's got a visitor. So Milarepa just sets to, just starts working, ploughs the field, and I think Marpa leaves him the beer, and so he has a good swig as well, and, you know, it's a lovely situation. Of course, he finds out when he gets to Marpa's house that the man ploughing is none other than Marpa. So the first meeting of Marpa and Milarepa is very significant. It's work. It's work. He gets Milarepa working. Doesn't say anything, doesn't even tell him who he is. It's a really interesting moment. He's not, you know, I think Marpa senses that this is somebody interesting. I think that it's a long time since I've read this stuff, but I think Marpa kind of knows that this is an interesting character. But the first thing is work, service. Throughout this song, there's reference to serving the guru, serving the teacher. Milarepa does say later, the best way to serve and please the guru is to meditate, but the first thing he has to do is to work for his teacher. I think because he can work and he just gets on with it, he doesn't say, oh well, hang on, you know, I want, you know, I'm here to learn about meditation, you know, I'm here to, you know, learn about Buddhism. The fact that Mira, you know, I'm not interested in working, the fact that Milarepa just works is a really good sign. It's a really, really good sign. And it kind of goes on like that. He goes and entreats Marpa for the teachings, goes into this place. Marpa says, yeah, okay, I'll give you the teachings, but first I want you to build me a house. And I want you to build me it here. They go to the place and it's got to look like this. And Milarepa does it, and Marpa comes along and says things like, I must have been drunk when I told you that. Because he did like his chant. I must have been drunk. We can't build here. I mean, this will upset my relatives. And it's the wrong shape. And it goes on like this, week after week after week, month after month, maybe even year after year. Marpa getting Milarepa to build and then telling him it's a mistake. I mean, it's comic the way the whole story goes on with, you know, Marpa's wife getting involved. She feels very concerned about Milarepa because he's got it breaking his back and getting sores all over his back doing all this building work for Marpa. And Marpa's a really weird guy. I mean, you tend to, you know, we've got this idea that kind of Buddhist gurus are going to be all sweet and holy and, you know, we're going to get what we want from them because they're really nice people. And Marpa wasn't like that. He was really kind of fierce. He was always having disputes with his extended family over property. You know, always kind of laying into people. And when Milarepa, you know, complained and got upset that he wasn't getting the teaching, disappointed, you know, Marpa's not interested. He's not interested. All he wants from Milarepa is complete and utter service and devotion. I mean, it really is. I mean, if somebody behaved like that these days, they'd probably get arrested and locked up. I mean, Marpa is really uncompromising, really, really fierce. But Milarepa, you know, the way he sings about him, my father, Guru, my father Guru. There's this tremendous devotion and gratitude and reverence, because what Marpa is doing, he won't give the liberating teachings associated with, particularly with meditation practices that he learned from his teachers in India and which he gained through great hardship. He won't give them, he can't give them to Milarepa, because Milarepa's state is so impure. He's got so much bad karma, so much impurity to kind of burn off because of his evil deeds, because of all this killing that he's done. He's got to purify himself. This is one of the reasons why Marpa sends Milarepa into solitary retreat. He sends him away and tells him to meditate, because Milarepa in a way only has kind of two choices. Because of the extremity of his behaviour, the extremity of his deeds, he'll either go to hell in his next life, he'll either be reborn in a state of intense suffering. There's that option. The other option is enlightenment. The other option is complete transcendence of the situation, complete transcendence of his circumstances, leaping over, if you like, his bad karma. No amount of good karma, no amount of skillful action is going to purify what he's done. No ethics isn't enough, certainly psychology isn't enough. He's going to have to break through into an entirely different sphere altogether. Liberation, nirvana, Buddhahood, in this very life. And Marpa gives him that. Marpa gives him that. Marpa is actually only interested in that. Marpa is only interested in that in Milarepa. He's only interested in his liberation. So when we start talking like this, Marpa is only interested in Milarepa's transformation, his liberation, his transcendence of his karmic situation, his existential predicament, we start getting insight into what a guru really is. I mean, the word guru is so degraded, isn't it? It's so, it's such a, in a way, a horrible word these days. I mean, you sort of hear it used. I mean, you get the word, financial gurus is a phrase, isn't it? You know, the ones that are really knowledgeable about finance. And there's so many stories about gurus being, terribly authoritarian or whatever it might be. Well, Marpa was, but anyway, that's another point. That was good authoritarian. Come back to that. but really, what is a guru? What does it really mean? What's really going on here? So let's try and unpack this word guru a bit. It's often translated as teacher or spiritual teacher, but that doesn't really convey what a guru is, and certainly what Marpa was. And Marpa certainly taught the Dharma. He could do that, but that isn't essentially what it means to be a guru. A guru might be a teacher. He might be a father figure, he or she, because there are female gurus as well. Could be anything, could use any means, but that's not essentially what a guru really is. Certainly the way my teacher talks about what a guru is, the way Sangharakshita talks about what a guru is. The word in Sanskrit, guru, is very interesting. It comes from a root meaning heavy or weighty with quality, with real quality, with real depth. A guru is a person with weighty qualities, with real depth of qualities. They're heavy with, if you like, spiritual qualities, Dharma qualities. Their very, very presence communicates that kind of quality. There's a kind of quality of the sublime or the profound about a guru. They're occupying a state of consciousness, a state of being that is definitely beyond our own, that is definitely higher than our own. It's interesting as well, there's a word which is translated as reverence, but reverence or veneration, they don't really quite convey it. The word is Gaurava in Sanskrit, which is the attitude you'd have to something or somebody that is weighty with quality. You would revere, you would really kind of look up to them, you'd venerate, you'd have that sense of wanting to sort of, bow down in your presence of that, in the presence of that weighty quality. I was with Jnanavacha this afternoon at the late Turner exhibition, and some of the paintings, you felt that weight, that kind of heaviness of presence. I don't mean a kind of oppressive heaviness, but just this sublime quality. You felt positively small in the presence of that. So that's really what a guru is. A guru is somebody who occupies that kind of space, that kind of quality of consciousness. They embody that for us. They possess that for us. They stand on that higher level of consciousness. And we feel that in their presence that, we're looking up. We want to cherish that presence. Because they, in a way, stand for something that we aspire to, that we want to become. We want to become. So that's essentially what a guru really is. And the guru will use whatever means to bring about that transformation. This is really important. A guru has no interest in maintaining, if you like, the status quo. I mean, it brings up the whole issue of hierarchy. This is a very, very controversial area in this highly egalitarian and democratized world in which we live. All of us have highly egalitarian consciousnesses and instincts. We're kind of bred to it. But the Dharma, the tradition the Dharma comes from, the tradition that Milarepa comes from, is the exact opposite. It's a highly hierarchical kind of vision and consciousness, but not in any way an oppressive hierarchy, not a fixed hierarchy, not a hierarchy that keeps you in your place, but something dynamic, something unfolding. Marpa's interest is in Milarepa's liberation. He sees what any guru, what any great guru will see, that what the essence of a human being is their potentiality to become greater than themselves, that they can arise, that they can unfold, that they can occupy the same kind of consciousness that as the guru themselves, even transcend the state that the guru is in. You even get stories of this in the tradition, where you get these teachers sort of leapfrogging each other and, you know, teaching, you know, from that higher space to the person who's now the disciple. That sparks the disciple off. They leap over the guru before them. There's some lovely stories about that in the Buddhist tradition, the sense of leaping over. So what we're talking about then between guru and disciple is not teaching. There might be formal teaching, but that's not essentially what's going on. It's communication. Communication. Communication all the time. Living together in deep communication. That's what Marpa and Milarepa have together. When you read the story of Marpa and Milarepa, that's what you're getting. Well, it's an amazing text, The Life of Milarepa, if you read it, because what you get is a record of intensive communication between guru and disciple. And the thing is, it's not explained. Poor old Milarepa really doesn't know what's going on. Marpa tells him to do something. You want the teaching? You build this tower. You build this hut. You do this, you do that. You work and work and work. Milarepa does it, goes for the teaching. You can't have the teaching. I'm not going to give you the teaching. Do you really believe that I'm going to give you the essence of the profound instructions that I brought back from India, from the great teachers Maitripa and Naripa? I'm going to give them to you, a black magician, just because you built a tower? And you've broken it down. And you've upset my relatives. Not at all. You know, and he's not interested in Milarepa's, well, that's really, you know, his staff and Milarepa's upset and his wife's pain for Milarepa. You know, Marpa often goes off in a sort of sulk when he gets told off and puts a kind of robe over his head and sits in meditation all day when they're giving him stick for behaving like this. Amazing. All he's interested in is Milarepa's growth and transformation. He's just, all he's concerned about is Milarepa learning. One of the things Milarepa is learning through his contact with Marpa is that he might well have been very adept at learning black magic. He might well be a very good worker. He might well be very, very good, in a sense, at getting what he wants. But that's not how the Dharma works. So the continual humiliation is throwing Milarepa back on himself. The continual promise of the liberating teaching, only for it to be swept away, is teaching Milarepa, you can't have the Dharma in this way. You cannot have it on your own terms. You can't have it on your own terms. If you want to grow, if you want to transform, if you want to liberation, you've got to give up wanting your own way, even wanting the Dharma on your own terms. And I think that's an incredibly important message for us. An incredibly important message for us. It really is extraordinarily important. This word beggar that Milarepa uses in the song, it's probably a translation of the Tibetan kusulu, which could be translated as mendicant as well. But a kusulu is basically somebody who's voluntarily taken on being a beggar, who's taken on being a pauper, who's realised, if you like, not just, or rather, the renunciation of worldliness going into mountain retreat, the renunciation of possessions, of homeland, the renunciation of family, the renunciation of all material things, living on bed food. That's really expression of an insight into the indigent nature of human existence itself. We have this idea that we make things happen. We work hard, we earn money. Actually, I don't work hard, and I don't earn money. But I'm sure you do. You work hard, you earn money, you study hard, you're living a life, you're supporting other people. There's this sort of sense in which we're doing all this stuff, and we're making things happen. I have that sense. But when you actually inquire, when we actually look at it, what have we got? What are we doing? What's our actual situation? What do we really have? What do we really make happen? It's all going to be taken away in the end anyway. What have we really got? There is a kind of poverty, you know, to our existence. This is, you've probably come across the word dervish in the Sufi tradition. This has nothing to do with whirling. A dervish means a pauper. A dervish means somebody who's realised that we really don't have anything in the end. It's all can be taken away at any time. Everything that we have can be taken away. This is a really shocking thought. And we can feel very helpless sometimes when we get down to this. There can be that kind of crisis that people hit even before they come into contact with Buddhism. They're kind of living a really good life. Everything's going really well. And it's they kind of look around, what for? Why? Why am I doing this? All this stuff, all these things that I have. It all seems to be covering up a terrible sort of emptiness. A terrible kind of emptiness. And I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm here for. You ever have that sort of feeling? You know, those sort of moments, say, in a party. And everybody else is having fun. And you're kind of looking at it. And it's all going on. It looks kind of like the dance of death. It's really weird, and then you sort of snap out of it, you have a drink, you have a joint, and everything's fine again, it's kind of like, I fixed the problem, because it won't go away. Milarepa embraces his need. One of the things that happens with Marpa is that he kind of gives up. He just gives up, but there's a certain sort of point where there is a real surrender. A real giving up to Marpa. And it's at that moment that Marpa can give him the teaching. He's given up trying to make it all happen. And we have to do that as well. You know, Buddhism's so easy to go. It's good, it's great, it's fantastic that, you have a Buddhist centre on the high street. It's fantastic, there's so much Dharma available. But there is this kind of feeling. All right, I come along, I get the technique, that's it, I've got my mindfulness of breathing, I've got my metta bath, and I've got it down. I've done my open retreat, it's sorted, it's fixed. Maybe I'll become a mitra, I'm in the ordination process, I'm ordained. it's sorted. You own it, you've got that sense of owning it. I mean, it's all worse now with the wretched internet thing, people kind of gaining enlightenment online, and you got it in your bedroom, you don't even have to go out your room, fantastic, you got your books and everything. You haven't got anything. Until you actually surrender, until you actually realise your poverty, until you actually realise your real need, you actually don't have the Dharma. The Dharma really begins when you realise that actually I need this. Not just to sort myself out psychologically and make myself a well-adjusted human being so I can party more, have more, be more successful and all that sort of thing, which of course is what everybody wants to do, incorporate Buddhism into your life. No, that isn't the need. The need is, actually, I am seriously messed up. Actually, and this world is seriously messed up. Not that, oh yeah, I'm a bit messed up because I have bad parents and all the rest of it. No, it's deeper than that. It's much, much deeper than that. And it's been going on for a very, very, very long time before this life. I mean, samsara it's really screwed. I mean, it really is, it's really bad. It's a real mess. And you've got to find a solution somewhere else. You've got to find a solution in another way. It doesn't mean you can't enjoy it. It doesn't mean that you don't really have great pleasure, you know, from this life. There's so much pleasure to be had. But you've got to realise, actually, there's something more that's got to happen. And it's not just using a bit of Buddhism, you know, to make it a bit better. We've got to go right down to a much deeper root. This is what Milarepa realises with Marpa. And when Marpa sees that, he can give the teaching. He can give these fantastic tantric initiations, these amazing kind of practices, you know, where these initiations where Lama Marpa is, you know, Milarepa sees him as the deity Hevajra, you know, with, you know, 32 arms and, you know, dancing deep blue Hevajra, embracing his consort, and, you know, these fantastic teachings. I mean, we don't need all that. But that's what Milarepa, the kind of vision that Milarepa had of his teacher. There's a wonderful thing that they have in the Sufi tradition. They say that the attitude of the disciple to the sheikh, to the peer, is that you should be like a corpse and the sheikh is washing you, and you are totally, in a sense, passive to the influence of the sheikh. It's that kind of shocking, that's that kind of shocking in a way, the complete surrender to the teacher and the teaching. So that's one of the things going on with Milarepa and Marpa. He's realised his beggary, if you like, and then the teaching can come in, and it really is liberating teaching. And this is the other side of all this. I've talked about samsara being, you know, we really are much worse than we think we are. The saying of Sangharakshita is, I'm a lot worse than people think I am, and also a lot better. And that's how, I think that's true of all of us. Well, actually, we're a lot worse than we think we are. I mean, we probably think, yeah, I've got a few problems, you know, can fix that a little way. Actually, no, it's much worse than that. And we're a lot better. I think one of the things that's so awful about the modern world is that we like it all bland. It's all so sort of, you know, soft focus and dull, mediocre. You know, but no, we're a lot worse than we are, but a lot better. I mean, Milarepa's a lot better because what Marpa sees, he doesn't just see that this guy is in a really serious mess and he needs to transcend it. Marpa sees everybody as a Buddha, as a potential Buddha. He sees not just Milarepa's darkness. He sees Milarepa with this, and everybody else for that matter, with this sacred outlook, as they call it in the tantras, this sacred vision, this vision that actually human beings, well, they look like human beings, you know, but a human being is extraordinary. This human body is so extraordinarily precious and wonderful because it contains within it all of the mandala of all the Buddhas, the liberating mandala of all the Buddhas. That's what it contains. If we could but see it, develop it, clear away the stuff in the way, imagine it, visualize it, and live from it, that's what Marpa sees as well in Milarepa. And this is why Milarepa can sing this song. This is why when he's in his mountain fastness meditating, that to see his teacher in vision, to remember his teacher, is just to fill him with blessing and kindness, is just to fill him with love. Because Marpa has given him this liberation, has given him this path of transformation. Yeah, Marpa is really difficult. Even in retreat, you know, Milarepa sings, what does he sing? Though this lamenting song recalling you might annoy you. Even then in retreat, he knows Marpa, you know, Marpa's not one for sentiment. He's not one for sentiment. It might annoy him that Milarepa singing this longing song, because Marpa, as you know, made it clear, you can do this. you can practice, you're off in retreat. In a sense, I think that's what he's saying. He knows that Marpa, you know, will be saying, you don't need this, you don't need this. But it doesn't matter. Milarepa needs to sing from this. He needs to sing this gratitude, this love for his teacher, and everything that goes with his teacher. And he remembers the exemplary life of his teacher, because he's lived with his teacher. This is another big feature of Dharma life, where the modern world is so different. You live with your teacher, or if you don't live with him or her, you spend a lot of time with them. And it's not just about the teaching of a technique. It's not just about a bit of meditation instruction. You see them. You see them in, you know, throughout the day, day and night, day after day. You see the way they interact. Where Milarepa sees the way Marpa interacts with his wife, with his sons, with his relatives, which seems to be continuous kind of warfare. I don't think Marpa went to war with them or anything like that. So, and that must have been very puzzling, mustn't it? Must have been very, very weird. Here's this teacher that's showing you the way, and yet he's got all these sort of human kind of foibles. You know, how weird is that? And that's a very interesting thing as well, that the guru, you know, in the tantric tradition anyway, they say that the guru is the Buddha. Which is very, very strange. Especially when Marpa is manifestly not behaving anything like the Buddha. What on earth does that mean? But as far as Milarepa is concerned, Marpa is the Buddha. And yet, Marpa seems to lose his temper. He seems to get a bit merry every now and then. What's happening here? What's going on? And yet, Milarepa thinks of him as the Buddha. I mean, there's another story. Marpa's Namtar, in his biography, written by the same mad yogi who wrote Milarepa's biography, there's this great moment. Well, it's a tragic moment, really. Marpa's son, his actual son, dies. Falls off a horse and dies. And there's this whole thing of Marpa trying to revive him through all his sort of magic tantric practices, and he can't do it, and all the rest of it. His son dies. Marpa is really cut up. As you'd expect if your son has died, guru or not, you know, you'd expect that, wouldn't you? But the disciples, I mean, they really must have had some backbone. They say to Marpa, Rinpoche, Lama, Jetson, you're always going on about everything being an illusion, and you're really upset that your son's died. You know, what's going on? Marpa says, this is a big illusion. Puts his blanket over his head. It's great, you know. And one of the things I love about these stories, they're very, very human. They're very, very human. And both views and visions are true. For Milarepa, Marpa is the Buddha because he gives him the liberating teaching. Because he is the Buddha for him. In a sense, I don't think Milarepa is... Well, probably Milarepa does think that Marpa is enlightened. There's a lovely thing that gives you a kind of insight into this. One of the best explanations I've heard of this. This is about a great West African Sufi by one of his disciples, talking about the relationship between the disciple and the master. Very, very touching. A man named Hampate Ba, writing about a great West African Sufi and his teacher named Chernu Boka. So Hampate Ba says, the disciple cannot not love his spiritual master because he is his master. For the disciple, the master has accomplished everything. Otherwise, the disciple would not have chosen him as his master. The master is the disciple's model. For example, I can say that for me, Chernu Boka is a perfected man. But that does not mean that he is, in fact, a perfected man. Because Chernobokar would not accept that title, but for me, he is a perfected man, because I have never seen anyone whom I would place above him. So this is what this really means. Milarepa has never met anybody who he would place above Marpa. So for him, he is the perfected man. He is the Buddha. He's given him the liberating teaching. He has communicated to him, with him, entirely in terms of his potentiality as a Buddha. That's all he's done. He's not interested in, not even particularly interested in Milarepa's past, his background. Marpa's only interest is in Milarepa's potential to be a Buddha. And he's ruthless in bringing about that growth, that transformation. And this is why Milarepa sings with such a longing devotion for his father guru. Father guru is a very common term in Tibetan devotional literature. Father guru, because it's a guru very much as the spiritual father, and you've been reborn through the hands of the guru. There are women gurus as well. I don't know if they call them mother gurus. I presume they do. And it's this sense of spiritual rebirth into the life of transformation that the guru, the spiritual friend, the father guru brings about. It's a new life, a new way of living, a liberated life. Time is running on. There's more we could say about this particular prayer, but I think there's another lovely word I just want to bring out here I shall repay my father guru's kindness through repeated meditation. Nurture me with kindness, O supreme guru. Bless this beggar to succeed in his hermit's isolation. Nurture me with kindness. I've talked about Marpa's fierceness, but it's all in this context of kindness, this nurturing through kindness. This word nurture is quite important, actually, this spiritual nurturing. And it reminds me of a teaching of the Buddha, I think I ought to close with this, because I think we need to kind of make it kind of practical for our circumstances, because frankly gurus are hard to find. Gurus are hard to find. Gurus are hard to get. It's not a good idea, I don't think, to look for a guru on the internet, like a kind of dating agency, go along to somebody where somebody appears with all the guru paraphernalia, whatever that might mean. You discover a guru, you discover that kind of communication through meeting someone. You need something else beforehand. So I want to stay with this word nurturing as a way into that, to bring the teaching perhaps a bit nearer. Recently I was studying in our community at Padmaloka, a very famous sutta from the Pali Canon. So we're going right back to the Buddha. Very beautiful sutta, lovely sutta. It's called the Meghya Sutta. And in this sutta, the Buddha has a young monk as his attendant named Meghya. Meghya, I think it might mean cloudy. I'm not sure. Megha certainly means cloud, and maybe there's something deliberate in his name, I don't know. But anyway, Meghya says to the Buddha, I'd like to go and beg my food in the nearby village. And the Buddha says, do what do you think it's the time for, Meghya? So Meghya goes off, begs his food, and then goes for a wander to digest his food and to do a bit of exercise. And he comes to this fabulous place. It's by a river. It's a lovely, deep, dense mango grove. Mango groves are so fantastic. They're so deep and dark, very dark leaves, very cool. And he thinks, this is a place for a young man to strive in meditation, if the Buddha gives me permission, I will come here to strive. He goes back to the Buddha And he says what he found. He says, I want to go there and strive, if you give me permission. And the Buddha says, wait, I'm alone. Wait until another monk comes to look after me. Ah, Bhante. The way he addresses the Buddha, Bhante, I'd really like to go there. You're enlightened. You've done everything that needs to be done, but I haven't done that. You know, I've got so much to do. Let me go there and strive. And the Buddha says, wait till another monk comes to look after me. But Lord, you've done everything that needs to be done. You're enlightened. I've got so much to do. I need to go and strive. And the Buddha says, ah, well, what can I say, Meghia? When you talk about striving and striving on in meditation, do what you think it the time for. I really do imagine the Buddha's perhaps ironic smile. So Meghia is off. He plunges into the density of the mango grove, and he really goes for it with his meditation. But weirdness upon weirdness, strangeness upon strangeness. He's gripped with thoughts of sex, of food, of hatred, of violence. You know, you ever have those meditations? No. It's just absolutely... And he thinks, this is really weird. I went forth, a young man from a good family, I went forth out of faith into the homeless life to strive, and now I'm filled with these thoughts. This is really weird. This is really strange. I'm going to go back and tell the Buddha. So he goes back, tells the Buddha, and the Buddha is very good. He doesn't give him a ticking off and say, I told you so. He doesn't do any of that. He just gives this wonderful teaching. And the Buddha uses this wonderful phrase. He says, a bit hard to get it in English, when the liberation of the heart is immature. When the liberation of the heart is immature. Five things conduce to its maturing. Its maturing. This is really a lovely expression of... this is the connection with the word nurture, by the way. You'll get it in a minute. The heart's liberation, citta vimoksha. Vimoksha is liberation. Citta is heart or mind, consciousness, being, if you like. It's as if we're restricted, we're held in. Enlightenment, the path, is this wonderful freeing of heart, mind, being. This wonderful expansion. It's a wonderful image for what enlightenment is. This expansion. But it's immature at the moment. It's undeveloped. The word in Pali is paripaka. Paripaka. Which is a lovely word, paripaka. Paka, the last bit, is actually paka. You know paka. Paka meaning, you know, it's one of those words that's come into the language. Paka means, yeah, great, good. Paka literally means soft, cooked, can even mean ripe, ripe. Paripaka means, therefore, the ripening, the full ripening. When the heart's, the liberation of the heart is unripe, five things conduce to its ripening, its maturing, developing. Lovely expression, lovely image for the spiritual life, that we're ripening, we're swelling, we're softening, we're expanding. Such a lovely way of talking about Dharma life. And you can really feel that sometimes, can't you? That's actually happening to you. Well, what are the five things that the Buddha says? The five, and the most important, he said, is the first is Kalyana Mitrata. So not a guru. Not a guru, because that word is so loaded, but it means the same thing, really. Kalyana Mitrata, which we can translate as a really lovely friendship, but Kalyana is one of those gorgeous Sanskrit words. It means lovely, beautiful, skillful, good, auspicious. It's all those things. And the implication is that the good and the skillful are beautiful, are lovely, are auspicious. It's, I think when we, you could say it's dharmic friendship. It's the friendship where you're, the friendship itself is dharmic, the friendship is about the Dharma, the friendship is all about that maturing, that ripening of the liberation of the heart. That's what's going on between you. That's the first thing. And in fact, the Buddha goes on a bit later and says, all the other things come out of that. All the other things in the Dharma life come out of that. He says it's more than a friendship. He uses another word, not just spiritual friendship, but a kind of intimacy, something really close, really, really close that you have with other people, a really close, intimate spiritual friendship. And spiritual friendship meaning this real ripening, maturing, this expanding and transformation of heart and mind and being through the Dharma. That's really what we need, first of all. If we're really going to find a guru, we're going to find a teacher like that. That's what we need to engage in, first of all. Something in a way very ordinary, friendship, but which is characterised by this, you know, wonderful expansion of consciousness. But what does that look like? What does that look like? And the Buddha gives a bit of an indication of that, because he talks about the four other things that come from that. What's going to be going on in that? I'll be brief because time's short. He said, well, when that's going on, when you've got that, what you'll expect to see is an ethical life, a skillful life, skillful behaviour, not about being good. Siddhartha is going to teach it, so I don't need to dwell on this. But it's interesting the way that the Buddha talks about this. He talks about you see danger in the slightest fault. You see danger in that. So the implication is that you're really vigilant and alert. You've got this really tuned up conscience. You've got this sense of, if you like, beautiful and ugly action. So it's not about being good, it's about being intensely beautiful in your action. You know, you notice that sometimes when you catch yourself, you know, saying something unpleasant or doing something rather mean. It just seems so ugly. Can I do that? So cheap. So ugly. You know, so ignoble. Whereas, you know, when you do something, you know, really skillful, quite naturally, because, you know, it's usually after the event, you look back, oh, that was good. You think there's a dignity, a healthy pride and self-respect in that. So it's a friendship that has that kind of quality going on between you, encouraging goodness, that beauty between you. And then the Buddha says, another thing you're going to get with this is, again, our language is so sort of impoverished, is the Sanskrit is dhammakata, talk, conversation, communication, which is the Dhamma itself, and which is about the Dharma, but not in an artificial way. Again, it's this, you know, this real communication about the truth. But yes, you will be talking about, you know, Dharmic ideas within that, but it's about getting that shift, that movement of the heart, which is turning you away from that limited, restricted kind of state you've been in before, that's opening you up to something greater. And then the Buddha says that the next thing that comes from this is the fourth thing, isn't it? Is energy, virya, energy, which is intensified energy towards the skillful. Particularly, what the Buddha is talking about here is meditation. Meditation in the sense of the uninterrupted stream of skillfulness, whether you're on the cushion or off it. I love this line in this song. One of the ways Milarepa serves his guru is to unite life and meditation. Wonderful phrase. The union of life and meditation. Maybe in the meditation today, I don't know if you... I had a really smashing Meta Bardner, which didn't sort of feel as though it was free. So I sort of assumed you were all having a really fantastic Meta Bardner. Well, the next thing is to unite that with life, that Meta Bardner. When we go home, on the tube or the bike or whatever it is, and go home to our families and the workplace tomorrow, how do we carry that over, that Meta Bardner, into our life? How do we keep that stream of skillfulness going? And then the fifth, and that's another thing that spiritual friends, that friendship that we have with spiritual friends is going to be encouraging in us. That's why spiritual friends are so important. They encourage that skillfulness, inspire in us, urge us on when we're feeling a little bit downhearted with it. And then the fifth thing the Buddha says is to see the constant rise and fall, the impermanence of all things, the arising and the passing away, and the arising again and the passing away, this vision of the ever-changing nature of life. And the Buddha says when you see that, that dissolves away the I am conceit, the pride of I am this particular person, I am this, I am not that. It's dissolved with the vision of the rising and passing of things. So in spiritual friendship, we're going to be shown the truth. We're going to be introduced to the truth. We're going to be helped to see things as they really are. We really need spiritual friends to help us to see that. Milarepa, after his a later stage in his spiritual life, has this wonderful song. I think it's maybe the Song of the Snow Ranges or the Song of the Yogi's Joy, I can't remember, where he's describing being in the mountains. This time he's a master, he's a guru himself. This time he's not full of these sort of longings for Marpa. He's attained mastery, if you like, although he's full of gratitude to Marpa. And there's this wonderful description of this mountain place where the fog comes and the fog goes and the rainbows appear and the rainbows go and the monkeys are chattering and the birds are singing and Milarepa is watching his mind, you know, the joys, the sadnesses that are just floating through his mind. And he says, the more ups and downs, the more ecstatic I become. The more ups and downs, the more the arising and ceasing I see, the happier, the more blissful I feel. All, of course, because of the blessing of Lama Marpa. So this is where we end up if we please the Guru, if we follow the Guru, if we have this vision of things. But before I finish, there is another way we can encounter the Guru. And that's, of course, within ourselves. Milarepa, and he's in retreat, seeing Lama Marpa, in a way he's beginning to internalise the teacher, internalise the Guru. And we have to do that. We have to do that right now. The teacher has to come inside us. All the great Tibetan masters, Tibetan gurus talk about this. Where is the teacher within us? Well, it's in what's called apramada, vigilance, alert awareness of what we need to do in order to bring about the maturing of the liberation of the heart. That, vigilance, and spiritual friends. You have those, you've got everything. Thank you.